Welcome to the Growing EBITDA podcast, where we unlock the doors to management and technology insights in the middle market. Join us as we explore innovative strategies to drive revenue and EBITDA growth, interviewing industry leaders and technology experts. Whether you're looking to streamline operations, understand the latest tech trends, or lead your company towards exponential growth, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and let's grow together.
Welcome back to Growing EBITDA, the podcast. Are we famous yet, James?
I think we actually crossed that big threshold, Mike.
15 listeners?
Yeah. If you take that and make it like 650, pretty close.
Wow. Moving up in the world.
Mm-hmm. Really moving.
So what's going on in your world? Busy week?
Man, let me tell you, we've had quite a few deals moving quite quickly. We just had a team, got a call on Thursday, did a diligence on Saturday, report due this Wednesday. So it's moving out there. So exciting start to 25.
Excellent. Excellent. So today we're talking about how private equity creates value in the first 100 days. So building on your prior comment there about speed obviously in the private equity business, very important. Today we're going to spend some time talking about just how fast paced it is, but really just focusing on the first 100 days, right? What's a private equity firm trying to do in the first 100 days of owning or investing in a new business for their portfolio? We're going to try and tailor it to our audience. You know, we're going to try and make it so that private equity lay people can understand this, right? So it's not a, we're not going to tell private equity investors how to spend their first 100 days. We're going to hopefully shed some light for maybe some management teams that are newly backed or newly owned by a private equity fund, or some management team members who are looking at the private equity industry from afar, trying to think about how they get into that business or that industry, which is a very exciting space these days. Fun fact, 60% or more of private equity backed businesses are going to undergo a transformational change in their first 12 months of ownership. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about that today.
Yeah, I think we see it a lot, Mike, whether it's someone who's been a cash managed group moving to accrual base, or just some of the folks don't make it through the transition. It could be financial shakeups or management shakeups, and they seem to happen in that first 100 days. So that's an interesting statistic.
So we're really going to cover three things today: assessing the business, and obviously most private equity firms, all private equity firms, I would hope, are going to do extensive diligence on a business before they invest in it. But there's still a lot to learn after the fact, right? So when we say assess the business, this is kind of in addition to doing due diligence, which would have been before the investment. So we're going to think about, or we're going to talk about assessing the business, fixing any challenges, inefficiencies, or problems that were identified during diligence. And then last but not least, aligning leadership, right? Private equity fund who invested in the business is likely going to have some improvements or opportunities that they've thought about independently from management. Management may have some things that they want to work on now that they have a new owner. And getting everybody aligned on the same page is obviously of critical importance early in the deal cycle, so that everybody can be rowing the boat in the same direction as things progress.
I like the tee up there. Let's just get right into it, right? Does that make sense to go through some of it? Maybe you can ask some questions, because I'm coming off of one of these pretty recently. Maybe we'll kick it to you to ask me some questions, and then maybe I can hit it back to you for some of the follow-ups, but let's just jump in.
Yeah, let's do it. So we're going to talk about assessing the business, right, and setting priorities. What does the first step look like after the deal closes? What do those first 100 days look like, James?
Yeah, I think we talked a little bit about it, but what is interesting, and we get a chance to see this because Trivista isn't a financial group that's doing quality of earnings, or we don't have an accounting team that comes in. And so really we get to participate from the sidelines, and I'll talk about a little bit how it's intertwined, but really they start to dig in on those financials. And maybe this is something that after I finish my section, you could let folks know a little bit more about on kind of how the deal goes, because I have covenants I need to make. I have additional reporting and visibility that's required. So I'm really going to make sure those components are there. And then even more, being private equity backed, and I think in a previous episode, we talked about how deals are structured with a mix of debt versus the equity. That cash flow component is pretty important. So in those first 100 days, the PE firm or the sponsor is going to want to come in, work with your business and understand what the cash flow is, what the information. A lot of that should be known through the diligence process, but we all know there's kind of those unique things that are found out afterwards. And if folks don't ask the right question, maybe you're not letting them know all the information. I think identifying this financial risk is important, but really you need to start driving value. So yes, you need to have a pulse, you need to have visibility, but that operational side really comes into play. So a lot of times if an organization or a sponsor has engaged an outside firm such as Trivista do an operational due diligence, you essentially have a cheat sheet to say, hey, there's the five things that I need to do after I buy this company. I should probably start on these components and pieces, but I just need to kind of wait till the deal's done to start driving that change. So on that first day, even before the 100th day, you know, going in that management team, some of the conversations you want to have. Now, after a transaction, you want to be respectful, not step on toes, give some time, build those relationships of trust, but you have that in your back pocket. So those could be understanding inefficiencies in process. It could be supply chain issues, or it could be outdated systems that need to be worked on. But you have in mind what those look like, and you're going to start to talk about those gaps in that 100 day. You may not start to remediate, but you start to put the plan in place, start having that steady drumbeat with your management team, and start planning the ideas of here's the things that we want to change. And the last one that I think is around the leadership and culture side. You buy the business because it's a good business. You don't want to buy the business and implode the business. You like what it is. So you want to follow some of the things, whether it's that leadership team that's in place that you believe in, or that culture that you think really aligns for what your use case for that is. So you want to start to evaluate those management team strengths even more than you did in diligence. And you'll see that whether it's in board meetings, in your one-on-one calls, or as you start to have operating partners, which are folks from the PE firm that come in to help you run your business potentially, or outside consultants such as us, you'll really get to know that management team through more through their efforts and through their work. I think one of the things that is super important, and this is a bit to our PE friends, I know this episode is targeted at the acquired company, but to our PE friends, having a very specific, succinct list of goals that you communicate to that management team, very important in the first 100 days. Management team, very important to ask or understand those goals and start to align yourself to those, because not only do you have a business to run, now you have that sponsor that you need to be able to communicate and have that connection with. And then the last part is maybe you have an influx of cash, maybe you have a little more time on your hands because you got some help in some things, but what are those gaps in people you need to fill? Quickly escalate those, because you know you've got the financial change to make, you know you have operational change you need to make. Get those people in place, communicate that early with your sponsor to say, hey, I know I need someone on FP&A. I don't have an FP&A individual. To get a lot of the stuff done you need, I probably need that FP&A, and start that recruiting and get that rolling that first 100 days. But going back to the first one around the financial side, Mike, I mean, you sit on a lot of boards and see this. What are some of the financial things that you see in the first 100 days that would make our listeners successful?
Yeah, I think the first 100 days can look very different depending on the type of business or maturity of the business, right? A lot of private equity firms buy what have historically been family-owned businesses. So maybe you're talking about a situation where a founder has owned a business for 30, 40, 50 years, some cases longer, and got the business to where they could take it, and now it's ready for a next generation of ownership, so to speak. In those situations, this could be the very first time, you know, that diligence process that would have taken up the prior 2 to 6 months before closing the deal, a lot of things could have come up in discussion amongst the management team members, amongst the investors that were looking at the business, the investors that ultimately ended up investing in the business. And it could be, in some cases, it's the very first time in the history of the business that the entire business, the entire organization went under the microscope. And it may be the first time that some outside perspectives are coming in, right? Whether those are the investors themselves or consultants that they've hired. So there just may be some rocks that have been looked under, not necessarily that skeletons were found in the closet, but they're just going to have a lot of really smart people looking at a deal pre-close and coming up with ideas and opportunities for improvement. And likewise, a management team of a founder-backed business for the very first time is thinking about what does the future look like without the constraints of the prior owner. Not necessarily a bad thing, but you know, many family-owned businesses are managed to produce cash flow for the shareholders. Private equity businesses are similar, but they have a little bit more patience to them, right? They're okay not making as much cash maybe this year and reinvesting more back into the business such that the business can grow faster in subsequent years. So you could have that situation. You could have the opposite of that, where you could have a very mature business with a very strong leadership team, maybe that's already been owned by a private equity firm. And those two experiences are going to look a little bit different. But generally speaking, one thing that is constant across all those examples is, as it relates to the financials that you mentioned, James, is just making sure that all the parties understand what the expectations are for financial reporting, right? The cadence that the new owners and the new board are expecting to receive updated financials, the format that they're expecting to receive them in so that they can crunch their numbers on their end and do all the fun things that they're going to do with that information. And obviously, the financial statements are a reflection of the heartbeat of the organization, right? It tells the investor group whether or not the business is healthy, if it's performing at or below or above expectations. And that's where a lot of the future subsequent conversations are going to start from. You know, I think on the operational side, you're right. A lot of folks are going to do some type of diligence, operational diligence on the business. They're going to have a sense as to where they think some opportunities for improvement exist, or maybe where some risks are that, you know, don't necessarily have to mean material risks, but just some risks that they would like to mitigate. Maybe it's improving cybersecurity. Maybe it's filling a leadership team gap that exists. Could be any number of different things. You know, I think beyond the financial reporting, though, one of the things that I think is most important is the relationships that the investors have established with management and vice versa up until that point can be a little bit tenuous, right? Hey, these are new owners. If I'm the management team, these are new owners. I don't really know who these folks are. They kind of seem smart, or I didn't really get that much access to them, so I don't really know if I have an opinion of them. It could be anything like that. Likewise, the investors are looking at the management team like, geez, I hope this team's as good as I thought, right? During diligence, I hope we're going to be able to achieve what we're all setting out to do, which is why we bought the business in the first place. So I think sitting down and breaking bread together is always a really good idea. I think some of the best firms, private equity firms that I've seen, and some of the best management teams that I've seen out there, they make it a point in the first 5 to 10 days after closing, even though everybody's kind of typically tired from doing the deal, they make it a point to sit down in person, break bread, get to know each other, ask some personal questions beyond the business. Because, you know, like it or not, you're now kind of married to these folks for the next 5-ish years, maybe longer. So I think a lot of the folks that do it well really appreciate and understand the power of that relationship. They get that financial reporting in place. And quite frankly, CEOs, if they're not really focused on this, or maybe they haven't had a board historically, you know, that first board meeting can be critical. How you show up, how prepared you are, how thoughtful you are, the team members maybe that you're bringing alongside you to showcase them to your new board of directors and kind of share with them some highlights, you know, that the business has to share at that particular point in time, that can go a long way too. So I think just generally kind of getting everybody aligned in terms of what are the priorities for the business, aligning the relationship so that there's the foundation for kind of success in the future, right? This whole thing is going to hinge on different humans with different personalities in different geographies, maybe even in different languages, all kind of cohesively working together and drumming to the same beat to take the business forward. That's super important. So I think assessing that, getting those building blocks in place, and then starting to tackle some of the opportunities that lay before the business in a collaborative way.
I actually got to attend one of those meetings that you talk about, kind of meeting and hanging out and going to dinner after the sponsor. And we went and met with the management team post-close. We had talked about some of the different elements of the business, but really hadn't dug into all the elements. And we're on this ERP selection. And in our conversation, it's like, hey, you know, we really want to kind of drive down those closing times because we think we need them faster than the covenant. This is the PE firm telling the management team. And so afterwards, I pull aside our PE partner and I say like, hey, what is the average closing time for getting the books closed for this business? And his answer was 75 days. I thought to myself, good gravy. No wonder they have us in here doing an ERP selection for that visibility. You're right. So that was not only a breaking bread, but starting to preempt some of these major rocks that they wanted to move. Okay, let's move on to the next topic. What you got for me?
Topic number two, operational efficiencies. You've got the team starting to break bread together. As I alluded to a second ago, now it's time to, you know, get down to brass tacks, right? What are we going to do to grow the business, make it more profitable, de-risk it? A whole host of operational efficiencies and improvement opportunities. So once we've assessed the business, right, how do we prioritize what we're going to work on next that's going to drive immediate impact, midterm impact, long-term impact? How do you think about prioritization?
Yeah, I think one of the things that visually comes to mind, and we do this a lot in our diligence decks, and we're helping companies out on their journey, is I think of the X and Y axis, and one of those being the value and the other one being the effort. And so when you start to think about how do you kind of prioritize and put these things together, I would tell you just simply grab a whiteboard or a sheet of paper, draw a plus sign on X, Y axis, and put value on the bottom and effort on the top, and start to plot in and just a conversation, understand where they are. Because the things that are the easiest are high value things that are low effort. So those could be very simple things, like for example, process automation. Today, we have our AP group, our accounts payable team, manually creating these envelopes, putting them in one by one, and shipping them out. Let's outsource that as a very simple win. It's a couple bucks to do it, and we get back employee number 5's time because they're not stuffing envelopes and sending them out. That process optimization is an easy one when you think about that. Also, there's a lot of repetitive tasks in a business, especially in the mid-market with a lot of our family-owned and family-run businesses. You might have folks that are in legacy roles that have been doing that for a while that's just kind of working. And this new ownership group is a chance to take a step back and say, how can I drive out repetitive tasks and really get the most value out of my team? And then another one I also see in that kind of process size is streamlining those workflows. So we see kind of this ping pong effect where I have to go to one person, they come back to me, then I go over to this person. And there's just this kind of spaghetti chart of like confusion. It's a chance to look at those processes and say, hey, you know, let's just get things moving. Like, let's just move along. Let's not have a bunch of red tape. What are those processes that we can clean up? Sometimes you need an outside group to come in and help you on that because folks are really happy with what they're doing today. And other times you don't. A big one, and we've talked about this a couple times, is that cost control and savings. Like, how do I start to find ways to reduce waste and drive out some of that waste today? Now, we'll find some of that naturally as you go through and look at those processes. But as you start that financial review that you mentioned earlier, and you're talking about kind of having that visibility to the team and talking about how you're going to manage, you'll see some of those things that could be wasteful. So a big one that we see often is I've got 3 groups that have kind of come together under a sponsor, and they're all buying their raw materials separately instead of coming together and buying it through one kind of, you know, group purchasing power. And so we see those a lot of times as you start to go through that plan, those 100 days to say, are anybody else in the group of portfolios from X PE firm buying these same materials? And how do we partner them to get the best price and drive that down? That goes back to the renegotiating of contracts as well as part of that process, because you may think, I know from my world, I'm buying this software from Microsoft at $35. This other company's buying it at $32. Let's go have a conversation with Microsoft and we'll buy it together and save some money there. And then I think this is an interesting follow-up conversation we should have, Mike, and bring a guest to, which is around the procurement side. So how do I put in programs in place to allow procurement? So no longer do I just go buy from this group because I've always bought from Grainger. I'm going to continue to buy from Grainger. How do I put together an RFP pack, go out and really kind of bid this out and put those processes in place in the 100 days? You may not need to use it because you're not going to go change a vendor in the first 100 days potentially, but you at least have that conversation teed up and built. And I think to build on something you said earlier, pulling some of those conversations forward to set expectations and putting together those building blocks for that time is pretty important. And then the last one, near and dear to heart, technology and systems. If you've done a diligence with us, we'll have pointed out a lot of these, and I'm sure most folks who do diligences look at the same things. What are those ERPs they have in place? Are they outdated? Are they not compliant? One of the things I think that the Trivista team, we really take a lot of pride on because we are tied back to operations, is that business enablement. So coming out of that diligence, am I enabling or disabling my business based on that system? So is it not only bits and bytes outdated? It may have been the business outgrown the functionality of the system. It's still a valid system that would run, but not really helping me what I need. Again, going back to another thing you said, data visibility. What are those reports I'm looking for? What do I need? If I don't have a common data repository, how do I get that stood up and talk about it in the 100 days? And then how do I start to integrate and pull my tools together? Most of the time, and I think this would be interesting to hear from you, most of the time, our clients are buying a company to scale it. They're not buying it to keep it where it is and sit on it. They're buying it for something they want to scale. So when we go in and do a diligence, we always have this question every time we talk about system. Does it break at 2x, 5x, or 10x? And that's a question of scale. How far can this system take me in my process? Can it handle more transactions? Can it handle more manufacturing? Can it handle a larger organization? And so a lot of times we have those conversations around scale. So I know, mm-hmm. again, those are kind of my points around like yeah. process, cost, and technology. What do you kind of think in that space yeah. of operational processes?
You know, like you mentioned, the systems are oftentimes a big deal, right? If the business doesn't have the right system in place to take it to the next level of maturity or the next level of growth, changing out a system could take, I mean, 18 months at the short end, 36 months at the long end, right? And if you've got a private equity firm who wants to own that business for 5 years, if that is something that they want to tackle or that management needs to tackle, wants to tackle, that's got to be, you got to kick that off very early in the ownership cycle. So, you know, first 100 days, that's a great fit there. You know, I love the classic benefit effort analysis. You can't be a consultant if you don't have a conversation where you introduce that tool set. But as simple as it is, it's a really effective tool, right? So I think what you're going to find is that most private equity investors pre-close are developing their investment thesis and hypothesis about how that thesis is going to come together. It's going to hinge on things like process optimization, cost control, cost savings opportunities, what ERP system is going to get us where we want to get to. And very quickly post-close, like we talked about earlier, aligning with that management team, sitting down with the right folks, getting the right plan together, talking about benefit effort and sequencing and prioritizing what's going to move the needle. Also recognizing that not every business is going to be perfect when a private equity fund invests in it. And certainly no business is ever going to be perfect when they exit it on the back end, but trying to optimize it as best they can is really the goal.
Hey, so Mike, maybe that leads us to our third topic that you mentioned earlier, the alignment of the kind of that leadership team and the strategy side. And maybe this is one that you could answer. So obviously having your leadership buy in, because you said you bought that organization to grow it and because you believe in it, and you probably believe in at least some or most of the leadership. How do you ensure that management team is aligned to everything we just said and ready to kick butt, take names, and execute? Like, how do you tie all this and pull it together and get it to that management team in a thoughtful way?
Well, I think you'd be surprised that it's very seldomly the private equity fund has a strategy that they're giving to the management team and getting the management team aligned around that strategy, right? That's really not how it works. Kind of a common misconception, though. Most private equity funds are buying businesses with management teams that are in place with no intent of changing those management teams that much, maybe a little bit on the margin, right? Maybe the business has never had a proper CFO before, so they're going to bring in a new CFO, but that's going to be to complement the management team, not to supplement the management team. Again, go back to what I've said a couple of times on this episode and others. You know, most private equity funds are trying to invest in businesses and own them for about 4, 5, 6 years. If you're only going to own it for a relatively short period of time, you can't change out the whole management team, right? That'd be a lot of disruption. It would take a long time to recruit the right people, then to get them to work together cohesively. That takes a little while, right? The big cultural shift there. So most private equity funds are backing management teams that know how to grow these businesses and maybe just giving them more resources or giving them more permission or giving them more capacity to go and grow them. And I think, you know, back to what I said earlier, the investors sitting down with the management team and vice versa very early in the ownership cycle. And oftentimes this actually starts happening in diligence, right? As they're getting to know each other, the PE firms are asking 1,000 questions about the business. The management team's got 1,000 questions about the private equity investors. So it's not like this is the first time they've ever met. But sitting down early in the ownership cycle and validating that everybody is on the same page when it comes to the growth strategy for the company and the underlying investment thesis that the investors bought the business or invested in the business using, and then driving accountability on a go-forward basis, right? Which typically is the responsibility, quite frankly, of the CEO, right? And that kind of goes both ways. The CEO is in every board discussion. The CEO is kind of tasked with understanding the thesis of the investors and mapping that to the growth strategy of the business, and then turning around to his leadership team and getting them motivated and incented and aligned around achieving those goals. So there's just a lot of work around alignment of stakeholders and shareholders. And then it's about just driving accountability, which quite frankly, you know, I've seen it done 1,000 different ways. For those folks who are familiar with things like the Danaher Business System or the ITT Leadership System, GE had one of theirs. There are very tried and true tool sets, whether it's X Matrix, strategy deployment, goal deployment, Hoshin-Kanri, Plan, Do, Check, Act, OGSM. Like, there's 5,000 management consultant tools out there. At the end of the day, it comes down to, do we have the right people on the boat in the right seats? Do they know which direction that they're trying to point the boat? And then how do we get them all rowing? And it can be very simple. A simple Gantt chart with due dates and milestones and who owns which action, that goes a long way. So I think clearly communicating the vision in the first 100 days, critically important. If you are going to do some leadership adjustments, like add a new CFO or something like that, let's get that kicked off soon, right? Don't wait 3 years to go and do that when you're going to get ready to sell the business, right? Let's do that pretty quickly so that we can have the, yes, you're going to get the cost early, but you're also likely going to get the benefit and the impact early in the cycle. You're going to gain more visibility if it's a proper CFO into the financials. They're going to help you make smarter decisions faster. They're going to close the books more quickly. Your financial reporting is going to improve. And that's just the example of the CFO. And then last and certainly not least, like I said, tracking it, measuring it, and holding people accountable to doing what they said they were going to do.
Yeah, Mike, I think those are some great points. A couple highlights on that. And it's a lot of times we hear from consultants like, about consultants, you come in and just tell us what we already knew and you put it in a document. And it's true. And I love the point you made is writing it down, documenting it, having that information there is so critical for folks to understand what it is and be able to be on the same page. And then, but my favorite point of everything that you said was really it's that management team is the one that's accountable. Just because you have a new sponsor, some additional cash or some, you know, folks that are working with you and maybe additional help, at the end of the day, ultimately, the accountability sits with that team to continue to drive value, drive the business, grow the business, and make those changes. So it's not a hands up, put it in autopilot, enjoy. It's, you know, maybe a little bit of guidance and help. So I think that's a great point for our listeners as they listen to this. We're not saying this is a disempowering thing. We're saying you're empowered more and you have more responsibility, but the ability to grow it even faster and stronger is there because you have that financial backing. So that's an excellent point.
Well, James, because this is an episode about the first 100 days, right? Not the first 100 years.
Yeah.
This one's going to be a shorter episode for us because I don't think we need to belabor it. I think we've given people the highlights. Get the right people on the team, get them aligned, and get things moving to the extent that there are opportunities that you want to take advantage of. So to wrap things up here, a little trivia, right? Your favorite.
I love it.
What percent of private equity deals involve operational improvements as part of their value creation plan?
So I love these because we, as you've heard in other episodes, folks, we're not the best at guessing these. So I think we're like 0-20. But I'm going to say, based on my win rates.
Didn't we get one wrong twice? I think we're like -1 out of 20.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. That's fair. That's a good stat. We'll have to go to producer Matt to have that checked out. One of the things I think is, you know, because we do the post-close work and we do the diligence work. So I'm going to go on my win rate. I'm going to go 75% because 75% of the time we get called back to do some sort of work. So 75% of the time.
So I'm gonna give you the answer by telling a story. Ooh. That I think people in the private equity industry are going to be very familiar with. Those less familiar with, right? But the private equity kind of buyout world dates back to the 80s, right? One of the most famous ones, the RJR Nabisco deal with KKR. A few deals in the 80s, a lot of deals in the 90s, thousands of deals in the 2000s, 2010s, it became tens of thousands of deals as the industry has grown. In the 80s and 90s, the answer to that question probably would have been less than 5%, right? Private equity investors were buying businesses with strong cash flows, with durable business models, kind of hoping they could just pay down some debt and they'd make a bunch of money when they sold it on a few years later. We call that kind of like the financial engineering era. As we got more into the 2000s, we started to enter the operational improvement era. And this really kicked off like 2010 to 2020 and still to this day. And these days, the vast majority of private equity deals are going to have a very thorough operational value creation plan. In fact, the stats that I was able to find suggest that 85%+ of the time, there's going to be a plan in place. And I think, but I would stress, James, for the listeners who are a little bit newer to kind of how this works, very rare do we see a private equity fund present their plan to the management team and just expect them to go and execute it. That's just really not how it works. And in fact, I've seen a lot of managers kind of disappointed or let down is the wrong word, but maybe surprised that somebody wasn't handing them a, hey, you should go and do these 10 things. It really is a collaborative conversation where the investors have probably made some interesting observations, third party outside perspective observations about the business. They want to conjoin that with management's in place strategy, maybe tweak it on the margin and let the management team get back to running the business and keep growing it, which is what they're, you know, hopefully best in the world at doing, right? So vast majority of the time these days, it's you're going to see one of these plans.
Sounds like, Mike, I need to get out there and hustle a bit more. I'm missing 10% of the addressable market, but that's a good tip. And I think that taking the plan, just a final story before we close is I had this mentor and I was asking for some advice on something and we were talking about a subject and I was like, hey, you know, like what's something that I should do in this situation? And the comment back was, just so you know, at some point, the people that you're going to get the advice from is no longer there. It's you that's going to be giving the advice to others. And so I think that growth opportunity and having that plan and to that point of you can't just always knock on that door. Sometimes you're the one that's going to have the answer was a great conversation from my mentor, great comment by you. And I think that's the note I'd leave on for the management team is take these things and look as a way to empower yourself and be prepared for those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We'll catch you next time. Don't forget, like and subscribe to the most popular podcast in town. Until then, we'll see you next time.
See y'all.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Growing EBITDA. If you like this episode, hit subscribe or follow us on LinkedIn for updates. Got a topic you'd like us to cover? Drop us a message. We'd love to hear from you.